Always fun when Sean Scanlon, Connecticut comptroller. Or do you say comptroller for the state of Connecticut? What's the business card say?
I think it says state comptroller.
State comptroller. You don't need to specify Connecticut. I mean, I have a list in my Ted Kaczynski book here of things I want to talk about with you. First of all, though, how was the summer?
The summer was good. It went by too quick, as it always does, but it was good.
Are you allowed to take like a vacation?
Yeah, I'm allowed to take a vacation. My wife and I are both workaholic type people, though, so it's very hard for us to do it, but we do take 1 week of vacation per year.
And do you go to the shoreline? Do you rent a place? Do you go to Tahiti?
Yeah, we rent a place and by the beach and just take a couple of days with the kids and have a nice couple of days and try not to work, but it's hard for me to do that. But
is it a hard shift? Back to school makes life easier?
Well, my kids are still not in school. So my youngest guy will go to kindergarten next year. So they're still in daycare, though we call it school. But that's like a 365 operation. There's not really like a summer break for
them. And that's not a full day, right? Or they do full
day? It is a full day, yeah. And we pay an arm and a leg for it, as many families in the state do. But yeah, it's, you know, we were talking about our finances last night. I won't say the exact dollar amount that we spend, but it's nearly the average of our mortgage. And for most people in the state, it's just not sustainable.
Well, you know, we don't have a ton of time in this spot, but it's a great segue because I talked about insurance. We had the president of the Insurance Association of Connecticut. The percentage of income that people are spending on stuff like insurance and daycare.
It's crazy.
The discretionary. For a middle-class family, the amount of discretionary, people don't have any money.
Yeah.
And I don't know where the relief can be. And maybe it goes into this energy thing, because I'm also not, and I'm not partisan, you know that. I find it ironic that now the Republicans want to spend this money. Although if it's ARPA money, it's one-time money, and it makes more sense to do that than to plug a budget gap that we're going to have to eventually pay for in perpetuity. But that's a different debate. But I really realize that people just don't have the ability to pay. So what do we do? Like the energy thing. Like if you were running the show?
Yeah.
I mean, I liked what Lamont said. He's like, we can do a special session and maybe we can give him money, but like that doesn't fix anything.
No, and he's right to be telling the truth about this, right? Because we're in the silly season of election. Democrats are blaming Republicans for the 2017 Millstone deal. The Republicans are blaming Democrats because they don't want to come in and do this optical special session. Both of them and all of us need to just own the failure that we have not done a good job in the last 10 to 20 years of investing in the kind of infrastructure we need to diversify our energy sources. And that is why we have the problem we have today. Nobody that you talk to about this cares what happened in 2017. They're saying, what are you doing right now to fix the problem? And the governor is right. There is not an easy solution right now, even though people are telling you there is. The solution we need is to do what they started yesterday. Get in a room, talk about what we can do together, and let's come up with a game plan. But you're not going to do that at one time. And spending $200 million of ARPA money to save people $3 on their bill, when my wife showed me our bill yesterday, it went from $150 to $450.
Jeez.
Is barely noticeable. There are better uses.
Is that all it would be, honestly? Like, I mean, people throw these numbers around without me being able to vet it. Are you being serious that it's only would only be $3 of relief per $200 million?
The House Democrats did an analysis that showed that it would save the average person $4. I think my friends on the other side of the aisle contest that, and they've got a different figure. At the end of the day, it's not going to be a lot of money. We owe $600 million on the Millstone deal alone, right? That's 77% of why we're in this problem. So simply using $200 million of ARPA money is just not going to have the big impact that I think folks are expecting.
You might not know the answer to this, and we have to take a quick break. Is there an end date to the Millstone deal, or is it like a forever deal?
No, it's a 10-year deal.
Okay, so 10-year, and we're in year seven, is that?
Year seven, yeah.
So there's a chance to renegotiate that?
Or? And we should.
Right.
Right.
And at this point, they probably wouldn't threaten so severely to leave like they did last time.
Well, listen, we really need Millstone. And that's, I think, not been made clear in this debate. Right. They're an important part of this. We just gave them, I think, in my mind, a bad deal. Now, at the time, hindsight is 2020. They're saying we're going to shut down. We're going to leave. And
well, you were there, right?
I was. I voted against it. But the point is that Millstone is important to us. But Millstone is also important to the rest of New England, and we're the only ones paying Millstone in the way that we're paying them. So we need to renegotiate that deal.
To spread the burden around.
Yeah.
Sean Scanlon, state comptroller here on Brian & Company. We'll take a quick break and we'll continue with the conversation. All right, we're back here with Sean Scanlon. state comptroller here on Brian and Company. The energy thing. So your assumption is, I just want to put a ribbon on it. Because if you come up with a long-term thing, the conversations they had yesterday, that's kind of, I feel like I smell like a special committee to research this or whatever, and that's not going to satisfy people. So, like, is there a compromise to be had?
It's not going to satisfy people, but it's the right answer. And I think a lot in politics, we as politicians always reach for the thing that's going to make people happy. And that is the reason why we have these systemic problems in our state, is because we haven't actually been honest with people to say, listen, I know you all want the easy solution. I know you're all pissed off because you've gotten this unaffordable bill. I'm just as pissed as you are. But to sort of search for these easy solutions of saying, hey, we'll just pay off this, what is 20% of the big bill you're getting.
Right.
It's not going to really make a systemic difference in fixing the problem.
So there's two things. I'll just say one thing. I'm okay with it if it actually yields a concrete plan that can be actionable and within a timetable that's not 3 to 5 years to start working on it. Not finishing, but working on it. So if that's the case, then I want to see within a year or two an actual long-term plan. The second thing is, I ask you, because you're sort of in the weeds on this, if they did want to use, say, the surplus to give people money back, can they do that?
They can, but it's not something I would advise them to
do. But like, they don't have to change the law or go back to the 17 budget deal.
They started by saying they wanted to use the surplus and the rainy day fund. And I think they quickly realized that that was not just a bad idea, but also a hypocritical one, because they are the first ones to criticize when anybody else on the other side of the aisle suggests doing that.
But now, could they do it legally?
They could legally do it, yes. Okay. Now they have switched to ARPA dollars.
They is Republicans.
Yes.
Okay.
And that is a easier path forward for them to do that than it is for
the
surplus.
But I thought that was all spent on the deal we made last
correct.
Spring.
But what they're arguing is that money has been maybe allocated but not out the door yet.
And so then we're going to pull the money back from UConn and give it to this?
No, because what they're alleging is that the governor is also sitting on a pot of other ARPA dollars that has not been allocated to UConn or somewhere else. The governor said yesterday after that meeting that he would take a look at where things are at with that money and see how much there is. But what I'm saying to the people of Connecticut is, again, I understand your frustration. I'm just as frustrated as you are, right? But we cannot just expect that by saying, okay, we'll find $100 million under a couch cushion somewhere, we'll put that towards the bill. You will barely notice that when you get your bill. And I just think that money is better spent investing in things. Like last weekend, Massachusetts passed a $600 million infrastructure deal to change infrastructure when it comes to energy in Massachusetts. That's part of a big investment that they're making that Eversource is then making on top of what they're doing, right? That's what we need to do in Connecticut. We need to invest in the infrastructure. We need more solar. We need more water. We need more wind. We need all these things and then some. That is what's going to lower your bill. So if I had my druthers, I would say take the $100 million, take the $200 million, and let's invest that in something that's actually going to make people's bills lower in general.
You know, I wonder if the parties were tighter. You don't have to answer this. What that would be like, because, you know, Democrats dominate Massachusetts. Democrats right now dominate Connecticut. And so I think, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I think it makes a lot of sense. I just wonder if there'd be more Democrats taking the populist stance if things were a little bit tighter in terms of the politics here in Connecticut. We're talking with Sean Scanlon here on Brian and Company, the comptroller. Quickly, and I still want to get into you. I want to talk to UConn about UConn with you so badly, but I want to first talk about the surplus that you came out earlier this week with the projections. That projection's for the whole year of fiscal 25?
Yeah, basically is a projection that I put out every month of if the fiscal year ended at that point, we would have this surplus.
So it's way lower than it's been in previous years. Is that wrong?
It's lower, but it's about on average of where we've been, which is we alternate between like $100, $150, $200 million surplus projection.
Should I multiply it by 4 to get the year number, or is
that's the year number? That's for
that
the
would
year.
Be the year number.
We would
number.
End the year with that.
Okay. Yeah. And so, and then you're paying another little more than 3/4 of a billion from last year's surplus to pay down the pension obligations.
So it's not, it's confusing, but basically.
Yeah. We go back to one-on-one every bleeping time
There's an annual surplus.
Am I stupid?
No. Okay. This is very complicated, right? There's an annual surplus that's around usually 150, 200 in the last couple of years. We've had five consecutive years of ending with a budget surplus.
And projected for the next four at least to do the same thing.
But there's also something called the volatility cap, which is part of those fiscal guardrails that people here talked about 2017. Those have dramatically altered the way we budget and are the reason that we are now in a much fiscally healthier situation. Part of that says we're going to take money that we essentially get from people who work on Wall Street but live in Connecticut, which is historically very volatile revenue, and we're going to save that money, sock it away. You can't spend it. You can't balance the budget with it. And at the end of the fiscal year, you can only do two things with it. You can either put it towards the rainy day fund.
Right.
And if the rainy day fund is full, you can start paying down pension debt. Well, our rainy day fund is full.
So the rest goes to the pension debt.
So the rest goes to the pension debt.
It's like 800 and change, right?
So we'll do about $800 million and change this fall. And that will bring us to $8.5 billion of pension debt that we've paid off in the last 5 years.
Right. With like at least 30 more to go. But my question is, so without being irresponsible, if you were projecting through the end of this year, we don't know what that money's going to be. So we don't know what we might pay that down a year from now.
No, and it's also really important. I get a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who say, why are you sitting on $4.1 billion in a rainy day fund? Because when my wife and I sit at the kitchen table, it's raining. Or when my business looks at our thing, it's raining. Tomorrow, we will get a really big jobs report in this country. Mm-hmm. And that jobs report is pivotal, I think, for so many reasons, mostly because it will determine what the Fed does in 2 weeks in terms of lowering interest rates, which they are long overdue to do, in my opinion. But it also will tell us where the national economy is. And if the jobs report comes back negative again tomorrow, like it did last month.
Well, you say negative, it didn't have a negative number last month.
It had
nationally
a rise in the unemployment rate.
Correct. But there was job growth.
Sure. But if that unemployment rate rises again, there are a lot of economists out there that think that that means that we are heading into a slowdown. And if we're heading into a slowdown, that means that we could potentially head into a recession. Mm-hmm. And what is so important about that $4.1 billion is the last time we had a recession in Connecticut, 08, 09, we had $1 billion in our rainy day fund. Jody Rell used that in 2009 with the legislature, Democrat legislature. It was gone. We then spent the 2010s in a lost decade in Connecticut where we raised taxes, cut spending, did all these terrible things, and had no growth.
You need it for that rainy day.
That rainy day could be coming.
Yeah.
And if that rainy day comes, we need all that money to prevent all those things from happening in Connecticut. And I think people have sort of forgotten about how bad it got in the 2010s here in Connecticut. I do not want to go back there. And keeping that rainy day fund intact will help us avoid it.
All right, well, Bob Cox told me to tell you it's just going to be beautiful today. That's it. And I think your staff should get the day off. They should go enjoy the weather while they can. How about that? Would that cost the state a lot of money?
It would.
Yeah, okay. That's not going to happen.
It's still light out and nice at 5 p.m. So.
Okay. There you go. Tough boss. No, it's fine. I'm glad I'm not working for you today. I can have class outside all I want. Sean Scanlon, State Comptroller here on Brian & Company. Before I get to some other sort of more general issues, anything in your office or things going on that you want people to know about?
Well, you know, we're always doing a lot of different policy stuff, right? And so we're getting ready for the legislative session. We did some big pension reforms last year. I'm always looking at ways that we can reform our healthcare system as the guy who runs the largest health plan in Connecticut. So we got a couple of things in the hopper. We've been doing some investigations, actually. You know, the governor asked us to do this audit of the Social Equity Council, which is the body that basically gives out the cannabis licenses. And is somewhat the cannabis regulator, but there's been some problems with that. So
that's more with how they're spending their money.
It's
correct?
Not so much how they're spending their money; it's the process by which they're giving these licenses out, how that's working. And
I could have told you 2 years ago that they're using a lot of puppets to satisfy the equity, and they're paying them off, and then their equity stakes go down to like it's like the guy who is the guy in the Social Network. Who was his partner, and then he went down. They diluted his stake so much that he owned like 0.2% or whatever. I mean, that stuff's been out there off the record for a long time.
It's not great. So we want to clean that up and make that system better, and we'll have some proposals how to do that with this audit that comes out in a few weeks. But we stay busy.
All right. So listen, a couple of my pet peeve issues here, and I'm curious of your take because I appreciate your input. The XL Center, and you know, it's a tough spot. We don't have a major sports team. The place is, I don't want to say it's a dump, but it's kind of a dump. And I know a lot of people, we're going to have a gentleman on tomorrow wrote an op-ed in The Current about how it's just, it's wasted money. Mm. And then you have other people say, even with the, you know, the CRDA, whatever, they say, you know, listen, it's what we have and we have to milk it for as long as we can. And we need to get events in here. So we just have to do it. So they make a cost benefit analysis, say $150 million's worth it. If we get another 10 years out of whatever. And I didn't like, I mean, for me, I would love to find a way to get a new building or whatever, but I don't know if it's worth it. And, but I don't know if $150 million in that place when you don't even get all the upgrades you want is worth it.
We don't have billions lying around to build that new arena.
Well, we do have billions lying around, but not for this.
Sure. And rightly so, right? And there aren't a ton of private developers that are itching to help us with this project. I think this arena is the state's flagship arena. Is it the prettiest, nicest building in the world? No. But the work that they're going to do is going to drastically change the XL Center's ability to have big events and to monetize what we do. Think about that model of that arena. That arena is basically built in the Roman Colosseum style where all the rich people sit in these skyboxes because that was the model of 30 years ago when they built it. Now people who have money, they want to sit close to the action.
Of course.
They want to sit down there. They want to have bar service. They want to have food. They want to sit at a bar type atmosphere in suite level places. That work will do that. The second thing of this, and nobody talks about this, is the way that the trucks get in and out of the XL Center to set up a Taylor Swift concert or Bad Bunny or Dave Matthews Band, the trucks cannot even get into the arena. And so $20 million, I think, of the money is just to change the ramp so that we can get different kinds of artists and bigger venues. These concerts are all now spectacles, right? 30 years ago, Van Halen just showed up with a guitar, drums, and some lights, and they played a show. Now this is a huge spectacle with lights and all this stuff. We can't even host most of those concerts, and we lose them to the casino, which means we get nothing off of this.
You know, so, first of all, I understand that. And you're young, so you're going to be like, but in 20 years, what are we going to do? And, you know, like, what's the, we talked about long-term plans.
Yeah.
You might be right in the short term, right? So maybe it's a 10-year thing, but are we going to continue to lipstick on the pigot until it actually collapses?
I don't think it's easy to predict what the world is going to look like in 10 years when it comes to entertainment, right? What is going to be happening there? Some of these viewerships on all these sports besides football are down, right? People don't go to as much concerts anymore because Amazon and HBO stream.
Really? You think so? I feel like the concert stuff is, I might disagree with you there. I feel like that's where the artists are making their money.
They do make their money there compared to selling albums.
Correct.
They don't do that anymore. Correct. But what does that look like in 10 years? We don't know. I mean, we don't know what that looks like. Are we going to have to build a new arena eventually? Yes. But I think this is the right move for right now.
We're talking with Sean Scanlon, comptroller here in Connecticut. This whole issue, I don't know how you felt. I know you're a Democrat, but, you know, UConn had record-breaking applications this year. So much of it fueled, of course, by the popularity of the basketball and everything like that. And yet, you know, it's one of the smaller flagship state universities I even looked at. It's even smaller than UMass Amherst. And they want to get that up to from like 30. Well, I have the numbers here, but I don't know if stores is like undergrads like 20, and they want to get like the total enrollment to like 40. I think it's 32,000 is including the graduates. What do you think of that?
I need to see the plan, right? If there's a vision, it's got to be matched with a path to get there. And I think that that's something that we need to see from.
But if there were a way to find the because you got to build that infrastructure, structure, you got to build out dorms and whole bunch of other things. You need the space. But do you think we should grow the university or do you think it's good the way it is?
I think we need to grow the university long term, but I think the way we grow it is the important piece. Can you do that by investing in those satellite campuses and not just putting all our eggs in the store's basket, I think is a good idea, right? We were talking offline a little bit about Hartford.
Oh, right? My gosh.
The importance of that Hartford campus, what that would mean, not just for the city of Hartford, but for UConn. To have that be a much more vibrant campus where kids are living there and working there and playing there and hanging there. I think that's a big thing for our state. And if we can figure out how to do that around the state and not just sort of expand only in stores. I think that that's really the division that we got to go.
I mean, I said this offline. I've said it on the show many times, so it's not news. I think that we have to find a visionary way to carve off a piece of Blight or some space. And I like what St. Joseph's is doing, and I like what UConn is doing and putting a couple hundred kids in there. But I would love to find a way to make a campus or get an actual graduate school or something that has, like, not 200 kids, but like 2,000 kids.
Yeah.
And then I think it would buoy the city's economy. And I think that it would change everything. And it actually could lead to something bigger down the road. We'll take a break. I want to ask you about the Big 12 stuff, because I know you're a sports fan too.
Sure.
And we'll get to that next with Sean Scanlon. I'm curious if, I mean, you're a sports fan, right?
Yeah, huge.
By the way, a big BC win.
Huge BC win.
I grew up a BC football fan because I grew up in Massachusetts, and UConn football was 1AA. So it was the only major college football in the region.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ACC, they joined the ACC, and they've been really struggling. And I'm a big Bill O'Brien fan, too.
Yeah.
Maybe FSU's not that good, but that's just a huge, huge win.
It's a huge confidence boost for the program. I think we've had a couple of bad years. When I was there was the Matt Ryan era. So my senior year, they got to number two in the country, which is a big deal. And we had a great time on campus during that run. But
so do you view, like, because BC has a much richer history in football than UConn, but do you look at that, saying that kind of thing, and say, you know, UConn could be in that situation, or will UConn never be in that situation?
There's a lot of UConn football haters out there, and I'm not one of them, right? The team is trying as hard as they
can. I'm not a hater. I'm a skeptic.
Coach Moore is trying as hard as he can.
He's a great coach.
I don't know him, but it seems like he's doing all the right things with the tools that he has at his disposal.
Correct.
And I think as we talk about Big 12, people's initial reaction is, oh my God, we would get our butts kicked in the Big 12. But I think why they talk about delaying our entry with football into Big 12 5 or 6 years is because us going to Big 12 will help him recruit people. And if the Big 12 is investing some money that we don't have lying around to help us invest in the program, it could make sense. What I don't like about the Big 12, and what I think most of my fellow UConn fans don't like, is the idea of us flying out to Arizona to play these teams. And I think why we are thinking about making the move is because college sports and these alliances are breaking up. And I think the ACC may break up. And I think where...
You think the ACC is going to break up?
I think where this may happen.
Wouldn't that be an opportunity then?
But I think that the opportunity is that some of those East Coast ACC schools will then join us in a conference like a Big 12. And there'd almost be like an East Coast, West Coast Big 12. We would mostly play our Eastern Conference rivals. And then occasionally...
Oh, so you're talking a chess match. You're playing chess... And maybe I'm playing checkers. You're saying that you join the Big 12, then when the ACC falls apart, the Big 12 gets a chunk of that, and then maybe there'll be a geographic division of the Big 12, and then we could go in the eastern part of that and play Maryland, BC, Syracuse,
correct,
blah, blah, blah.
Correct. I think the breakup of ACC would have to happen first, and we'd have to have some other people jumping in the pool with us in order for us to jump in.
So then we don't join the Big 12 now then.
I don't know what the timing is, and I want to be clear for the record here.
Yeah,
I'm
no, not, we're like, just shooting the breeze as
in
to
these negotiations. Yeah. I know the players, we've had some conversations. I think it's very, very preliminary right now, but I do think as a fan, right, not as the comptroller, as a fan, I would want to see something like that versus just us joining the Big 12 and playing Utah, right? Like I don't
And, you know, but the ACC doesn't act like they care about UConn. So because the ACC makes more sense.
Yeah.
But it's not like they're looking to expand, and you don't hear stories about UConn being a part of it.
But if the ACC is going down, which people think it might be.
Well, Florida State and this other school, I don't know, the two schools want to get out.
Joining that ship is almost maybe like joining a sinking ship. You'd rather have the survivors of that sinking ship come with us and we go somewhere else. But all this is like a Game of Thrones, insane money game that is
but
not
that's
great.
The thing is that they don't want to, the Big 12 doesn't want to let them in until 2031 because they don't want to share the money.
Right.
It's not that they want to give UConn time to ramp up football. They don't mind kicking the crap out of them for 5 years until they figure it out. But it's really just about whether you want to be a football school or not.
Yeah.
And the essential question is, do you think that we should have a football program on par with the top 25 teams, or should we be like Gonzaga and just have really good basketball?
Football programs make money.
Not here.
Not here. But
BC probably loses money.
But they make money in schools that have good football programs. I don't know that we can ever get there, but I think the
So you think it's worth the risk?
I think
because your basketball programs will change forever.
I think we have like one more shot at trying to get the football program to be in a place that it can help us financially as a university. And if that doesn't work, then I don't know that there's anything that's going to make it work.
Yeah, it's hard for me because I feel like UConn men and women's basketball, they go into this, say they go into that conference, they will never be able to dominate it the way they do now.
Yeah.
And they would be permanently diluted. But I will say that I think Hurley is going to see how this run goes. And I'm not saying he won't fulfill his contract, but the way college athletics is so tough. I mean, I feel like if he has more success, I think he'll go to the NBA because I think it's so hard to, you got football programs spending $20 million. We can barely spend $1 million here at UConn. And so I just think it's not really amateur sports anymore. It's like a pro sport.
It's pro sports. And I'd rather be in the Big East than anywhere else. But I just don't know the Big East is going to be around. And I think that that's what's causing us to take a look at this. Not because anybody wants to leave the Big East. I mean, how would you ever want to pass up MSG, right? That tournament is the coolest thing besides the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, you're totally right.
And that going away to place teams that mean nothing to us historically would not be fun. But unfortunately, this is a big business and we have to play it.
I want to end on something a little more back to the dollars and cents with Sean Scanlon, comptroller here in the state of Connecticut. We had the big void that was filled with so-called ARPA money last budget. How hard people, it's weird for people because I have people tell me this budget's going to be brutal because now that money needs to be accounted for. So you're already like a couple hundred million behind before you even start the new spending you might have. And other people say, well, we have all this money. So like, what's the budget battle going to be like in this session, in your opinion? I know you're sort of on the outside looking in, but you spend a lot of time in that body.
The budget battle is going to come down to a conversation that we need to have. It's going to be a hard one about what the future of the fiscal guardrails looks like.
You think there might be an effort to change it?
I don't think that there will be an effort to get rid of it. I think that there might be an effort to adapt it. And I frankly believe that we should have a conversation about what adapting it might look like. I think it has worked incredibly well in the first few years, but there are some flaws in it that were unintended consequences and things we could never have imagined.
Like what?
We may be capturing too much volatile revenue.
Right.
And so we may be putting aside too much money. When I got elected to the legislature in 2014, there was no money. Now, 10 years later, people are saying we have too much money.
Right.
That's a good problem to have.
But the volatility cap might not be that volatile.
Well, that's the thing. Can we look at calibrating it in a way that might make more sense? And so to all the people out here saying, well, you're sitting all this money, I understand that. We need to prepare for that recession like we talked about a little while ago. But are we capturing too much of it?
Yeah.
And can we change that formula a little bit to still prioritize paying down that debt and saving for rainy days, but maybe freeing up a little bit more money that we don't need to capture with the volatility.
Or maybe it can be fluid and it can go up and down with whatever that number is, like on a percentage basis.
Exactly.
So when things are leaner, it's not like you're more hurting, and when things are better and you can use more of the money, although if it's not for one-time expenses, it creates challenges down the road.
So our office has been looking at this issue, and my predecessor, Kevin Limbo, was the person who really recommended a lot of the policies that became the fiscal guardrails. And so, you know, we're having a lot of conversations right now. I think that there will be some public stuff about this pretty soon. But I think that that's going to be the topic of conversation. But if we can figure out a sustainable path forward on this, I think we're in for a strong few years in Connecticut on top of the strong few years we've had. And I think when you talk to CBI, you talk to businesses, they feel positive about Connecticut for the first time in a long time. Now we have to find a way to keep the momentum going and actually find ways to grow the economy.
We didn't even talk about business and expense to do business and getting more workers and people to live here, but I guess we'll leave that on the table for next time. Comptroller here in Connecticut, Sean Scanlon, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, sir.
Good to be on.